You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, did you ever think about running 40 miles? How about alone, with no aid stations or people to cheer for you? It's okay if that's not for you or for me, because we've got two Wisconsin runners who do that for fun and to set some records. First, we're seeing a major surge in new COVID-19 cases in Wisconsin. Today, DHS reported nearly 3,000 confirmed cases. Yesterday was a new all-time high with more than 3,000 new cases confirmed. Governor Evers' new executive order limiting many indoor gatherings to 25% capacity went into effect yesterday, and to help struggling hospitals, the National Guard has set up a field hospital at the Wisconsin State Fair Park in West Allis. We've also seen some new releases in recent days from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, including findings about the coronavirus and how it spreads. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the state's latest surge in cases? What are your concerns? What questions do you still have about the coronavirus and the disease it causes, COVID-19? Have you had it yourself? Have you recovered? What was the experience like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Patrick Remington joins us again to look at the latest numbers and answer any questions you might have about coronavirus and what we know about it. He's Professor Emeritus and Associate Dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, Rob. Thanks. Well,
we see the daily reports, Dr. Remington, with the numbers. Tell us where we are in the state. How bad are things right now?
Well, it depends where you are in the state. We have some hot spots in Wisconsin, in the Fox River Valley and up in the northeastern counties of the state. But, you know, there isn't a county that's been spared. So this is not an issue for just one place or one business. It's an issue that affects all of us. There isn't a person who's going to be spared, either in their health perspective or in the work that they do.
What has been the recovery rate so far from COVID, and how well are people doing after they get this in Wisconsin?
Well, the seriousness of the disease is directly related to the age of the patient, and also to whether they have any comorbid conditions or things like diabetes, obesity, and heart disease. With young people, particularly children, the disease course so far has been pretty mild. Relatively few young people get hospitalized, and most people are actually asymptomatic. Now, what we don't know is whether there are lingering effects. There are viruses that people get infected with early in life, and like chickenpox or HPV, that come back later and increase the risk of herpes zoster or even cancer. So we really don't know what the long-term effects are of people who have asymptomatic or very mild illness. On the other hand, the disease in older people, particularly people with chronic diseases, can be quite severe. And some treatments have improved, but I think in general, it continues to be a disease that causes severe respiratory problems. And you can see it in our numbers. We have record rates of hospitalization, and we had an all-time high number of deaths in the state. So it continues to be a serious illness.
And I know a concern from the start has been hospital capacity. We saw countries around the world facing problems early in the U.S., in the New York City area in particular. And now we're getting reports, especially I think in northeastern Wisconsin, that hospitals are coming pretty close to their capacity. What are we seeing there?
Well, despite some of the people who may doubt that this is a serious illness, all you have to do is talk to anybody working in healthcare. Talk to anybody in a hospital working in an intensive care unit, emergency room, and they will say that they've seen some of the sickest patients come through the door, patients who are having significant problems breathing and other organ system problems. So yes, it's extremely serious. And when you have an outbreak like we're having with thousands of new cases, particularly community spread, so that it doesn't just limit itself to young people. Young people often bring it back home to parents or grandparents. And so by spreading throughout the community, we will continue to see, with that kind of transmission rate, we will continue to see hospitalizations and, unfortunately, people dying from the disease.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health about the latest high COVID-19 numbers here in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the latest news on the disease. That's 800-642-1234. I know there's frustration out there, Dr. Remington, in the public health community around the fact that we know a lot of what works to stop the spread of the disease, the masks, the social distancing, some hand washing mixed in there. We're not doing those things, it sounds like, and we're helping the disease spread still.
Well, I think it's variable. I think there are some people, maybe some of your listeners could talk about how they've really developed a very safe lifestyle by sheltering at home. And when they go out, they wear masks universally and they practice good hand hygiene. And if they gather, they do so outdoors and maintain good physical distancing. And for those individuals, the risk of getting COVID-19 is very low. And so from that perspective, it's not a significant problem. Now, for people who are essential workers, for people who gather in high-risk places, indoors and poorly ventilated, perhaps bars or taverns, with people close to one another, then those are risky environments. And so for those people, it's not surprising that we've seen transmission. So I think everybody has their own sort of risk tolerance. Whether you have decided that you're going to do everything you can to avoid getting this infection, all the way over to the other spectrum, there may be some young people who've decided it's okay and they're going to go about their day and not worry about it. Maybe even engage in high-risk practices to get the infection and get it over with.
Now, we've talked some about the mindset here, where we think about it as my risk of getting this disease. And I think a lot of the attention is my risk of spreading this disease. If I have it, if I'm carrying it, maybe even unknowingly. Do you think that's a mindset that's going to help us slow the spread of it if we're thinking not just about protecting ourselves, but protecting others?
Well, this has been hard to, for people to really understand that there are two aspects to COVID-19. One is your own personal practices that affect your risk. And that includes time you spend indoors in poorly ventilated buildings, not practicing good hand hygiene, and not wearing a mask. So those are things that individuals do to protect their own health. But this is unusual in that wearing a mask, the research suggests that the best or the greatest benefit of wearing a mask is for people who happen to be sick and don't know it, for people who are pre-symptomatic or have the infection and are asymptomatic. Wearing a mask reduces the amount of virus that's put in the air. And so that's something you're doing for someone else. That's really something that you're protecting the health of others. And so to me, wearing a mask, you shouldn't think about one or the other, whether it's for you or others. It's just a good thing to do. And we should get that to be the norm when you can't be physically distanced or you have to go indoors to shop or decide to go out to a restaurant. Wearing a mask as much as possible is a safe practice, not just for you, but for others.
We're talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest news on the novel coronavirus, the disease it causes, COVID-19. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what we know about the disease, how it spreads, how to stop it? What have you done, if anything, to change your life throughout this long process, especially now that the numbers are peaking in Wisconsin, one of the national hotspots, or zooming in, a number of the national hotspots here in the state? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the latest record-breaking surge in new coronavirus cases in Wisconsin. Dr. Patrick Remington is with us from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, Professor Emeritus and Associate Dean there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has this changed your life? Are you changing your health habits? Have you done so over the course of this thing, doing more so now that it's getting worse in the state? And do you have questions? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Brian is with us in Fox Valley. Brian, hi.
Hey, how are you doing today? I had a quick question here about when a person is diagnosed with COVID-19, how long is the extent of time in which they shed virus to infect other people? Thanks. I'll take my question and answer off the air.
Thanks, Brian. Important question, Dr. Remington.
Well, it's a really important question. And the answer is there's a range. So when symptoms begin, the person has probably already been shedding virus. And that can last up to 10 days after an individual has had their first symptom. So that's the reason for isolation recommendations for anybody who's been diagnosed. You look at the onset of symptoms and you say for 10 days, we want you to be isolated so that you reduce the risk of transmitting it to others. That's different than being quarantined. Quarantined is when if you're exposed to somebody who's either known or probably has the disease, and then you have to spend 2 weeks away from others because you could be getting sick. It could take 3, 4, 5 days for you to get sick. And then there's another 10 days when you'd want to not be infecting others. So I think the best thing to do is not to have to memorize all these numbers and days. If you have any questions, certainly if you have symptoms, is to contact your health provider or your local health department. They have people who are contacting people all the time or who are ill or have been exposed to people who are ill.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Brian with us in Milwaukee now. Brian, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Brian?
I had a question about, I was just curious, it seemed like the death rate had gone down a touch from what I've been paying attention to, and I was just curious if there was new treatments or new ways that patients were being dealt with in the hospitals, ones that were severely ill.
Dr. Remington?
That's a great question. The most important predictor of the death rate is how many cases are being diagnosed, because as cases go up, then the death rate goes up. And so during April and May, we had quite a dip in the number of cases. People were really staying safe at home. But as people went back to business and got out more, as you have heard, the cases have skyrocketed to over 3,000. So that has driven the death rates up. The second thing is the age of the people being infected. So if we have at the end of August and during September, the real spike in incidence was in young people, particularly college students returning to campus. But that didn't lead to a spike in deaths because young people are less likely to be hospitalized and die from COVID. So it's really complicated. The number of deaths is an end result of the number of cases we're seeing, the age of the cases, and then the quality of the treatment. So teasing out how well the treatment is working and whether we've seen significant improvements turns out to be really hard to do. There's some clinical evidence, anecdotal evidence that patients are doing better with some of the new treatments. But the most important thing is to obviously be safe and prevent the illness in the first place. That's really what we want to see. We want to see that death rate coming down because of dropping incidence rates rather than hoping for better treatments.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us now in Rice Lake. Jeff, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to bring up, Jeff?
I got a question. Yeah, I've had COVID back in February before we really know what it was. My wife and two daughters work at one of the largest medical facilities in the state. And I'm just assuming my wife brought it home. just because we didn't know anything about it back then. So I had my antibodies tested to see if they're still there. And according to the lab, I'm in pretty good shape. I don't remember the numbers, but they said it was very high. And that's, how many months is that? March, April, May, June, July.
About 7 months by my math, Jeff. Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot for calling in, Jeff. And I'm glad you didn't have the worst case getting COVID yourself. I'm glad you pulled through. That antibody question, Dr. Remington, and immunity after catching the disease. What have we figured out so far about that?
Well, there's lots of research going on, and a study like this takes time. We don't have the luxury of looking back years or decades to follow people who've been infected, let's say in the 1950s or 1970s, and to see if they are still susceptible to infection. The evidence is that natural infection, particularly when someone is quite ill, increases the antibodies and does provide some immunity from subsequent infection. So I think the best advice is that you're probably less susceptible to getting infection again, but there have been some cases where people have been infected, they've developed antibodies, and then they've demonstrated a new infection from a slightly different form of the virus. So I think even if you've had infection, you have antibodies, you probably are less susceptible to reinfection. But I think the best thing to do, particularly if you are older or may have chronic conditions, is to avoid getting infected again.
Thanks a lot for that call. Anne joins us now in Madison. Anne, hello.
Hi. So I am a caregiver, and all three of my clients had COVID, and they were at home. And so I was testing every single day. I just drove over to the Alliance Center every day after work. And I was negative, negative, negative. And then I had one positive. So I figured, okay, I've picked it up. But there were two more results came in after that because I had been doing it every day. And the two after that were both negative. So I had like a whole bunch of negatives, one positive, and then two plus negatives again. So my job told me, go ahead and take 10 days off. The health department called me to do the contact tracing. And she said, well, you know, since you have had two negatives, you're probably good to go back to work. And that doesn't make, I don't know.
And thanks for the call. With the test we have, are there some false positives and or false negatives, Dr. Remington?
Without a doubt, there are no perfect tests for COVID. There are false positives. Sometimes people test positive, and when you actually look for evidence of infection, maybe look for antibody later, there's no evidence. That test just happened to be positive. There are other coronaviruses. Three types cause the common cold. Three or four types cause the common cold. So you could have some cross-reactivity. So having two negative tests is a general way to know that you're not currently contagious, and it seems reasonable then to have a green light to go back to work. But no test is perfect. So, and the other end is you could have a test and it could be a false negative. And so I think the best thing to do is to listen to the experts who do this testing, and then if you have any doubts, retesting is a way to confirm the first result.
Thanks for calling in. Dr. Patrick Remington is with us. We're talking about the latest COVID news in Wisconsin, and he's answering your questions. We'll go to Deb now in Menominee Falls. Deb, hi.
Hi. My question has to do with the treatment for anyone that's being diagnosed with COVID in the advent of or the aftermath of the president having been diagnosed and hospitalized and now discharged so quickly. We know that there was a cocktail administered to him. And what's the likelihood that the average person is going to be receiving that kind of a cocktail as part of their treatment plan?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, I think it's important that any treatment for COVID undergo rigorous clinical trials where people who have the illness are given the drug under study, but also then people are given placebo. The only way to know if a medicine works is to do an experiment and to compare it to the clinical course of somebody given a placebo. And we don't know that for that immune therapy cocktail that the president received. There's a clinical hunch that patients seem to do pretty well that when given this, but it's not proven. So I think the first question is we should all wait until rigorous studies have been conducted. The FDA has looked at the results of those and then decide if that treatment is actually effective. The next question is, do we have the resources to provide that to everybody? I don't know. I don't know the cost of that treatment. I don't know how long it would take to get into the sort of routine pharmacies. But the most important thing is to use the effective treatments that have been demonstrated. And I talk to healthcare providers all the time. They are looking at the evidence and using only proven therapies for patients in the state of Wisconsin.
Thanks for that call. In our last 30 seconds or so, what is your outlook for Wisconsin for the weeks to come?
Well, I think we're in a very potentially dangerous position because it doesn't feel like it today at 80 degrees, but very soon it'll get cool and then cold. And when people move inside, air does not circulate as well as outdoors, obviously. And so I think we don't know what's going to happen as the temperatures get cold and people go inside. So I think we have to just focus on the things we know work. Stay outside if possible. Wear a mask at all times when going outdoors, certainly, or out shopping. And then keep in touch with your friends and family. There's important during this time when we have to be physically distant to remain socially connected so that we don't have more impact than just the virus alone.
Dr. Remington, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Have a good day.
You too. It's Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus and Associate Dean at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at Wisconsin's record-breaking numbers of new coronavirus cases. Coming up, what happens when you're a runner, you're trained and ready to go for the racing season, but the events are all canceled? You set your sights elsewhere. Two Wisconsin runners tell us about fastest known time records on state trails. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, current and future U.S. foreign policy played a role in this week's vice presidential debate, plus reaction to the winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize. It's all on the Friday News Roundup today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a lot of runners were looking forward to competitive races this year and all the stuff that goes along with them, the competition, the spectators, and the swag bag, T-shirt, belt buckle, or whatever it is that you get to celebrate that particular accomplishment. But with many races canceled, runners have challenged their energy into a different kind of competition, a solo one, with no race-provided snacks, water stations, or participation T-shirts or cheering crowds. Talking about something called an FKT, or Fastest Known Time. Our next guests are Wisconsin runners who have pursued these records on scenic trails here in the state. Annie Weiss is a Milwaukee-based ultra runner and registered dietitian. She currently holds the FKT record for the 1,200-mile Ice Age Trail and the Wisconsin section of the North Country Trail. Annie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
And Nora Bird is an ultra runner based in Madison. She's a member of the Suunto Elite Team for 2020 and the owner of Team Bird Training, where she coaches other runners. She currently holds the FKT record for the Military Ridge State Trail, about 40 miles. Nora, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to ask each of you, what motivated you into seeking these fastest known time records? Annie, let's start with you.
Sure. So for me, fastest known times really kind of sparked my interest when racing in a competitive scene was always with my friends who are peak competitors that have become my friends. And I wanted to start racing in a different way. So I decided it was time to start racing against a clock or racing against myself. So that's where FKTs a couple of years back became an interest to me. And it just so happens that the way this year or the way 2020 is going with COVID, it's actually worked to my advantage. So because there's no races. So it's been really great to have that motivation and have FKTs available to do.
And Nora, what got you into this?
Yeah, I'm a little bit newer on the FKT scene, but similar. I really enjoy running alone. I have a few people that I run with regularly, but it's kind of really about racing yourself and kind of cheering for your peers and really pushing yourself in a time like this.
Annie, tell us how this works. It's kind of an unofficial thing. How do you pick a route? How do you measure it? How do you share it with others?
So a lot of the trails in Wisconsin, the three that, you know, the two I've done and the one Nora has done, are actually measured trails that people have previously done themselves. And there's an FKT website or essentially people in charge where you would submit your FKT route. So once you do that, then your route is essentially quote unquote official, and with navigational tools, GPS type things, you're able to go out and attempt to break the previous record holders, records. So that's really kind of how it works. And the planning process with deciding on a route is it has to be a justified, clear route. You can't just, you know, decide I'm going to run, you know, 92nd Street and that's going to be my FKT. It has to be something that is actually a point to point or a loop type of trail or road that you've submitted, and it makes sense to the FKT, to the people in charge.
Now, Nora, when I think of a big, long race, an official one, there's people maybe handing out water and things like that along the way, or an energy bar or whatever people are eating as they run. You don't have that if you're doing it on your own. How do you deal with the supply issue?
Yeah, so within an FKT, there's generally three different categories. You have supported, where you can get outside support who could set up something for you, where you have food and drinks and things like that. You have self-supported, where you can get things along the way, but you're not getting outside help. And then there's unsupported, where you do have to carry all of your water and food, which is the type that I set on the Military Ridge Trail for 40 miles. That wasn't a big deal. There was a little uncertainty because with COVID, a lot of the drinking fountains were not turned on. Thankfully, it was for me. I also have a little bit of things going on. I don't drink a lot of water when I run, so even I was prepared for them to be off.
We're talking to Annie Weiss and Nora Bird. They are long-distance runners, and they've been running fastest known time runs on trails around the state. Annie, now you've done a multi-day one. You just finished one, I think, this week, right, on the North Country Trail. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I finished at 1 a.m., so I got back to Milwaukee at 9 a.m. this morning. So, I actually went out this past Sunday to start on the Superior Hiking Trail, which is in Minnesota. And after 50 miles there, I just, my heart wasn't there. It wasn't for me. It's extremely challenging trail. And so I said, you know what? Let's make 2020 what 2020 has been, and just shift our entire focus. And my crew, we had a couple options, and we said, well, North Country Trail is 2 hours away. It's an already registered FKT, which starts at the southern end of the end of the Superior Hiking Trail, where Minnesota and Wisconsin cross. And you run from the border of Minnesota, Wisconsin, all the way to the border of Wisconsin and Michigan for 211 miles. So it was a quick switch, but yeah, it was pretty great. So now it's just a bit of R&R today.
Yeah, I think you've earned it. Now, Nora, you too and people like you are running on really scenic trails. Do you feel like you get to appreciate the scenery as you're doing what a lot of people, or I'll speak for myself, what I would consider a pretty grueling run?
Yeah, for sure. I did mine at the beginning of August, so I got it kind of in peak summer. And I don't generally run that trail, and I have definitely never run from Dodgeville to Mount Horeb. So that was a new section for me. And most people who probably know that, you know, the western part of the state is a little bit more filled with bluff and a little bit more landscape. So that was really beautiful to see, and I'm really glad that I was kind of out there by myself to experience it.
Annie, what kind of training goes into doing these big runs by yourself?
So there's two different schools of thought. For the FKT I set on the Ice Age Trail, my training was actually very, you know, long training days and very slow miles. So what we would refer to that is time on feet. And for what was supposed to be the Superior Hiking Trail turned into the North Country Trail, it was actually much significantly shorter miles with much more speed involved. So two different schools of thought, and both of them work really well. But, you know, I run 6 days a week and I take rest days, and I'll be taking quite a few rest days now. So it's a lot of recovery time, and it's a lot of very focused training, you know, for an hour or two, or I think my longest run to leading up to the North Country Trail was 3.5 hours. So it just, it kind of varies on what you're deciding to do.
And Nora, how do you work up to a 40-mile run on, say, the Military Ridge State Trail? What did you do in the lead up?
Well, I sort of decided at the last minute that I was going to do this FKT. So we had that sort of cooler snap in that first week of August, and I decided that would be a really good time. Being an ultra runner, we are generally putting in a lot of miles. You know, personally, a normal week is like 60 to 65 miles. So a 40-mile run really isn't out of the question. So it was just kind of, do I really want to run straight and flat for 40 miles?
Yep.
Now I want to ask, some people like me are not, this is going to shock our producers here, I'm not an ultra runner. Can you give me some motivation, Annie, to, you know, maybe not do one of these FKTs for a great distance, but to, you know, push my limits a little bit?
Well, and, you know, I talk to so many people about the same thing so often, because so many people think, well, I could never do that. How do you do that? I was never a runner. I, you know, through high school and college, I thought running was really stupid. And I thought people who ran were like, what are you doing? That's crazy. And so, you know, of course, then I go for a 20-minute run and then a 30-minute run. And all of a sudden you do a half marathon and a marathon. And it just, it slowly built itself over, you know, 5-6 years. And then all of a sudden you just, you know, you build that endurance so slowly. So it's really kind of saying like, well, I'd like to challenge myself with, you know, a 5K or a 10K, and to not, you know, overwhelm yourself with, well, I really want to do a marathon or an ultra, because that's kind of that's a scary thing if you're not a runner. So to start small and work your way up, you know, I personally, I think that works really well, and you can find joy, whether it's on road running or trail running, or maybe it's just hiking and walking, whatever it might be, but to just challenge yourself with something new and be able to get out in Wisconsin, because we have a really cool state with a lot of cool trails.
Well, I want to ask each of you what your next challenge is going to be when it comes to running. Let's start with you, Nora. What do you have your eye on next?
It's so hard to tell right now because everything has been canceled. So, you know, I mean, we've had a lot of stuff canceled personally, but I attempted not this past winter, but in 2018 to set the FKT across Wisconsin in February. And I got halted by that really, really bad ice storm that came through. So I made it 138 miles out of the 175. So I think that's on my list to actually establish.
Wow. And Annie, how about you?
For me, there's a handful of trails that we've been looking at. The top of the list is the Florida Trail, which runs 1,200 miles or so. There's the Arizona Trail, which runs 800, but with all the fires, that was what originally we were supposed to be doing in October. And then now, of course, there is the Upper Michigan, the UP, North Country Trail segment, which I think spans about 450 miles. So all possible, but, you know, this time of year with snow and hunting season, you know, you kind of have to be careful in our state and the surrounding area. So we'll look to spring for something for sure.
All right. Annie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And Nora, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Annie Weiss is a Milwaukee-based ultra runner and registered dietitian, and Nora Bird is an ultra runner based in Madison. They have both run fastest known times for scenic trails in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll get the latest legal twist on absentee ballots here in the state. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A federal appeals court has blocked a lower court's decision that would have extended the deadline to count absentee ballots by 6 days. The new ruling means that absentee ballots must be received before 8 p.m. on Election Day. The ruling comes as people around the state weigh how to vote amid a deadly global pandemic. In Wisconsin, we've seen a significant increase in the number of positive COVID-19 cases in the last month. Our next guest joins us to give us the latest in the court fight over the ballots and what it could mean for the November election. Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He's also co-host of the weekly WPR Politics podcast. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, give us more on this decision from the Federal Appeals Court. What does it mean as of now for how and when we vote?
As of now, it means that the deadlines that we usually face in an election, without a court intervening, are in place. So as you mentioned, absentee ballots have to be received by 8 p.m. on election night. And so that means that this extension that a U.S. district court judge had granted that would have given an extra 6 days for the ballots to make their way to clerks as long as they were postmarked by election day. That extension has now been thrown out by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago.
And I talked to some elections experts who said, even with that extension in place, maybe don't wait till election day to mail your ballot. I think the message from a lot of people has been still, whatever the court rulings are, get those ballots in earlier. Is there a sense, Sean, among politico types in the state that this is going to change people's voting behavior much?
I mean, we've had a lot of people voting absentee already. There's a pretty huge surge of absentee ballots that have already been cast in Wisconsin. So I think the message is out there. It's a little bit different than the April election when COVID-19 was still very new to all of us. And the thought of, going out to an election was still new. You do see a lot more kind of proactive people sending in their absentee ballots early this time around.
Let's talk about this ruling now. First of all, Sean, is this a final ruling or are there opportunities for further appeals that could shake up this story yet again?
There's always an opportunity. I shouldn't say always, but in this case, there is an opportunity for an appeal if Democrats wanted to. I haven't heard from them that they want to do that, though. They didn't say right away, well, we're going to take this to the U.S. Supreme Court, or, this was decided by a 3-judge panel on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. They could appeal to an en banc hearing in the Seventh Circuit where all of the judges who sit on the circuit rule on the case, but they haven't said that. I've just been kind of hitting refresh on the federal court system's website here for this case, just in case something happens while we're talking. And there's no notice of appeal there. Didn't hear a comment from Democrats yesterday. So, perhaps they will appeal. Perhaps they'll decide not to, that it's best to just kind of like work within a known playing field. Especially given the chance that even if they did appeal, the Supreme Court could side with Republicans.
Now, this is a 2-1 vote on a 3-judge panel. What did the majority say about why they ruled and said, nope, lower court judge, we're not going to let you extend the deadline for these mail-in ballots?
The majority opinion was really brief, and it was written by, one of two judges. It was Frank Easterbrook and Amy St. Eve, both Republican nominees to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And what they based their decision on was basically this Supreme Court principle, which is extremely loosely defined at this point. But the U.S. Supreme Court has said that you can't make changes or you shouldn't make changes in the court system to election laws close to an election. Now, there's like no cutoff for this. I mean, and it's cited frequently in election cases in different ways. And so in this case, this is what these two judges decided it meant. They said that this September 21st decision by U.S. District Court Judge William Conley came too close to the election. And that was why they rejected it.
And this is this thing called the Purcell principle, right?
Yes, I've been reading stuff right.
And it's a big deal this year in particular, because as you mentioned, with COVID, a lot more people are interested in absentee voting. And so courts, litigants and others are interested in how we absentee vote and maybe more motivated to seek changes in those rules. That's why we keep seeing this previously obscure phrase popping up so much.
Yeah. And it kind of raises a question in this case, which was brought up by the dissenting judges, like, okay, when's early enough? If Judge Conley had issued his ruling back in May, when coronavirus, you know, spread was much lower, would he have been kind of chastised for being too early? You know, it's this extremely, you know, the Purcell principle. Very good, Rob. It's super important in a year like this. And there's no date, I think, is the important thing. Each court kind of decides what it means to them at that moment.
Talking to WPR's own Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief, looking at a court ruling saying the deadline for ballots in November, mailed-in ballots, is Election Day, 8 p.m., overturning a judge's decision that said if you postmarked it Election Day, you got another 6 days for it to make its way there. So got to be there, 8 p.m., Election Day. The dissenting judge here, Sean, what was the message there?
Yeah, every now and then you read a dissent where the judge just kind of cuts loose, I guess, would be one way to describe it. And that is what happened here with Judge Alana Robner. She was nominated to the court by President George H.W. Bush. So another judge nominated to this panel by a Republican president. And she said that the inevitable result of the court's decision today will be that many thousands of Wisconsin citizens will lose their right to vote, despite doing everything they reasonably can to exercise it. She wanted to say, this is a travesty. So she also was very, you know, not critical of not only of the majority opinion, but of the Wisconsin legislature for kind of downplaying the severity of the pandemic, you know, kind of took the legislature to task for not making changes to election laws in the interim months between the April election and the November election. And her argument was basically, you know, it's a rare step. It should be a rare step for courts to step in and make changes to laws like these. That's the job of the legislature. But when they haven't done it, this is the time for a court to act. So she was extremely critical of both the majority and of the Wisconsin legislature for appealing this case.
And so for some background on the case, the appellant here was the Republican-led legislature, right? They are the ones who brought this to the court.
Yeah, and the way that it got there ended up being kind of messy. You know, it was decided at the district court level in favor of Democrats. Republicans appealed. The Republican legislature was one of those who appealed. And initially, these same three judges all ruled that the legislature lacked legal standing to bring this appeal, you know, that the legislature could not represent the interests of the state, that that was the job of the attorney general, basically. The legislature said, hang on, why don't you ask our state Supreme Court to weigh in on that? Because, you know, we have a law in Wisconsin now that was passed by this legislature in the lame duck session of the legislature back in the closing days of the Walker administration, where the legislature gave themselves more power to represent the state in court. So the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals sends it back to the Wisconsin Supreme Court to weigh in. The Supreme Court's 4-3 conservative majority says, yes, in fact, the legislature can represent the state in Wisconsin. That kicks it back to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And essentially these two judges changed their mind and said, okay, if you can appeal, now we'll consider the merits of the case. And as we look at the merits of the case, you win.
And that's where we stand. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio News. He's also co-host of the weekly WPR Politics podcast. He joined us today to talk about the latest court battle over absentee ballots in the state ahead of the November election.